to find out first your first experience with mathematics. What got you going in mathematics?
Oh, good question. I certainly always liked mathematics as a kid, but certainly Martin Gardner gets a lot of the credit for getting me interested in mathematics. I can remember running to the stands to get, usually I read them on the stands rather than buying it, each new issue of Scientific American magazine to get the next Martin Gardner column. So that was a big thing for me.
How long, from what age were you starting to read those columns?
Yeah, I really don't remember. Uh-huh. I just don't remember. Certainly, I was reading these when I was in junior high school, so starting seventh grade, but maybe it was earlier than that. Uh-huh. Because I remember I did trick my junior high school science teacher into believing that they had just discovered pi was rational and was equal to 355 over 113. And I know I learned that from one of Martin Gardner's columns.
Yeah. Going back a step, where did you grow up?
I was born in California and grew up in New Jersey, uh-huh. northeastern New Jersey.
Was there mathematics in your family background?
Not really. My family is heavily medical. Father, mother, both of my mother's brothers, and also my sister, my brother-in-law, et cetera, were all physicians. Mm-hmm. However, my grandfather did for a while as an actuary, and there is actually a book on my shelf about some calculations and insurance. Mm-hmm. So maybe there is some mathematical background.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had an interest in the Martin Gardner's columns and so on. How did that interact with your interest in school mathematics?
Well, it helped make it more interesting. Mm-hmm. It helped make me look for unusual features in mathematics in school, and gave me ways that I could trip up teachers, which I always loved to do. And later on, I did participate in contests and exams and things like that. Although we didn't have any involvement with as far as Olympiads or anything. Mm-hmm. We had local contests and things like that. And I always enjoyed those things. And so I've been collecting mathematical puzzles, really, since I was a kid. Uh-huh. But the idea of putting them into books was not mine. It was Klaus Peter's idea. Mm-hmm. He just came up to me in a meeting and said, I heard you had a great collection of mathematical puzzles. Why don't you email them to me and I'll publish them? Credit for
and that led to your first
that led to my first book. Yeah, my first book, second book, and the third one I'm working on now.
Now, going back to your high school days, when you were thinking about college, was mathematics a goal then, or did you have other possibilities in mind?
I was always going to be a math major or a physics major. When I started college, I took courses in both, but I discovered it was really the mathematics part of the physics that I liked. Mm-hmm. So quickly settled into becoming a math major.
Were there particular courses or professors that influenced your...
I think so. My first calculus course, and my first college calculus course was taken from Edwin Moise, who used the Moore method. So it was fun to get to find out that not everything was true, right? Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that. And then My sophomore year, I took the infamous Math 55 at Harvard, taught by Lynn Loomis and Shlomo Sternberg. And that was really a wonderful, challenging trial by fire. And but I enjoyed all my math courses in college, and along with playing bridge and squash, those were my favorite
things. You were at Harvard.
That's right.
And what was your thinking for graduate school then?
Oh, at the time, I was interested in algebraic topology and also in ergodic theory. I'd written an undergraduate thesis in ergodic theory. But the Vietnam draft was changing my my plans. So I was offered, so my plan was to try to get an occupational deferment. Maybe wait out the war and then get back to graduate school. My girlfriend's father, the physicist Edward Teller, offered me a job at Lawrence Radiation Labs, but it looked like it maybe even better was to work down in Washington for NSA. So I did do that, and while I was in Washington, I took a class in analysis from a guy named Choi Tak Tam. And he at the time was very enthusiastic about non-standard analysis. So what happened after that was they canceled all the occupational deferments. I ended up in the U.S. Navy. And for a while I was sent back to NSA, and then I was sent out to a swamp island. And I brought with me to the swamp island Robinson's book, Non-Standard Analysis. And I said, oh, this is fantastic stuff. I want to work with this guy who was at UCLA. But by the time I got out of the service, Robinson had moved from UCLA to Yale. And they let me out a couple of weeks early on some program that so you could start the your studies in that September. So, so I immediately went to visit Robinson at Yale, and by luck he was the director of graduate studies. So I said, I'd like to come to Yale and work with you, do non-standard analysis. He said, that's great, there's no problem, there's plenty of time, applications are not due until December, and so on and so on. I said, no, you don't understand. I want to start next week. So he said, well, that's going to be a little tricky. You know, there's a matter of money. So I said, well, there's no problem. I have GI Bill money. I have NSF fellowship. So let's see what we can do. So so I got in on no notice. I was only vaguely aware that Robinson was a logician, really. But thereby I fell into the hands of the logicians. At Yale, and I found logic to be quite fascinating. And eventually wrote a thesis in model theory. But my interests keep changing, right? So as you've seen, they've already changed a bunch of times. I took my, when I got my first postdoc, technically it's an assistant professorship at Stanford, I started getting interested in computability. Emory University, my first tenure track job, I got interested in combinatorics as well. And then that led to the theory of computing, and probability theory, and statistical physics. And keep seeing how mathematics fits together in all these different ways, and, and I love doing that. So, arguably, it could be said that I have evidence of having no self-discipline, and there may be some truth to that. I did solve a notorious problem of of Ron Graham and Henry Pollack while I was at Emory. Sometimes that was the squashed cube conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
And that got me acquainted with the various folks at Bell Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And so after some time at Emory, during which I rose through the ranks,
mm-hmm.
and I was chairman of the department for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought, time to try something new, and I went to work for Bell Labs
mm-hmm.
and its various
mm-hmm.
incarnations that we talked about.
Well, that was also an exciting time at Bell Labs, and especially algorithm development.
Oh, yeah, it was great. So,
those
yeah,
kinds of things.
It was great. It was really exciting at Bellcore, and then at Bell Labs. We had lots of stuff going on. We were doing coding theory to develop the 56K
mm-hmm.
bit modem, which is something that people would laugh at now, but
mm-hmm.
it was a big accomplishment at the time. And we were doing network design stuff, and we were doing
mm-hmm.
optical switching, and we were doing
mm-hmm.
All kinds of great stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
and after when Lucent and Bell Labs split, I became head of the of fundamental mathematics research at Bell Labs.
Mm-hmm.
I had just one leftover mathematician
mm-hmm.
from the old group, a guy named Ed Kaufman,
mm-hmm.
but I quickly hired a whole bunch more,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to build a great group, and the group was always very well supported, and we always had lots of interesting problems to work on, come from all over the country and all over the company,
mm-hmm.
And problems frequently led to theoretical as well as practical
mm-hmm.
work. So we had guys in coding theory, and we had guys in analysis doing waveguide design, and we had guys,
mm-hmm.
of course, we always have guys doing algorithms, and so it was a great group. It was lots of fun to work together.
So were you working with people like Neil Sloan? And
So Neil Sloan went to AT&T when a split occurred. So I was working with Neil at AT&T for only a short
mm-hmm.
time. Ron Graham went over there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the boss of the Mass Center at Bell Labs stayed,
mm-hmm.
Mike Gary.
Yes, I was going to ask that.
Gary and Johnson. And so I worked with Ed Kaufman and all these other new people
mm-hmm.
who came into my group. And I hired Carl Pomerantz,
mm-hmm.
the number theorist, and Michael Weinstein, the analyst, and theoretical computer scientists like Sanjeev Khanna, who's now
mm-hmm.
at Penn. Coding theorist Sasha Barg, who's at Maryland, and Amin Chakralahi,
mm-hmm.
who's now in Lausanne at ETFL. Bruce Shepherd, I stole from London School of Economics, does polyhedral combinatorics.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually my most loyal guy. He was the only guy who was still there after the group disbanded and I left. He still stayed for another year before
uh-huh.
I went off to McGill, where he is now.
Uh-huh.
And lots more. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So it was a very exciting time, and things were great. And it wasn't until the beginning of the 21st century
mm-hmm.
that we had the dot-com bust and the consequent telecom winter,
mm-hmm.
as we called it. And Lucent Technologies was selling off pieces of itself,
right.
including the fiber business and
mm-hmm.
all kinds of other stuff. So they no longer had much call for long-term research.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually, so for a while the job became everybody just find jobs,
mm-hmm.
and the people in my group all had very good jobs, and I was very happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually stayed extra year by special request, partly to do job counseling, just at the
mm-hmm.
request of management
mm-hmm.
at the labs.
Mm-hmm.
I spent most of that year at the Institute for Advanced Study,
uh-huh.
but shuttling back and forth,
mm-hmm.
Helping people find jobs,
mm-hmm.
and all kinds of stuff like that. And then I went off to Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm. What was attractive about Dartmouth for you?
Yeah, they did a great job on me. I really like the idea that Dartmouth was trying very hard to eat its cake and have it too,
mm-hmm.
by doing a really good job with undergraduate education,
mm-hmm.
and still having a very lively research atmosphere in its math department. And they seemed to get away with it. And I thought this was a great endeavor, and I would be happy to join. I had a couple of friends there. And in fact, they actually hired Carl Pomerantz the year before I left.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought that was it. You know, I couldn't imagine they would have two professorships, and somehow they came up with a second one. Partly it was because they were building Kemeny Hall. They were,
mm-hmm.
they were building this beautiful, yes. new math department in the middle of campus, named
mm-hmm.
after former president, mathematician John Kemeny. And so they managed to somehow talk the deans into giving them two professorships. So I said, okay. And so Carl and I are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of other good people, too.
Now, Kemeny, as I recall, is a developer of BASIC.
That's right. So Kemeny and another guy named Tom Kurtz,
mm-hmm.
who actually still runs the Bridge Club up there,
oh.
they developed BASIC, and they also developed the server system of computing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
That was first set up at Dartmouth, where you could go
mm-hmm.
to a terminal and type stuff in BASIC, which
mm-hmm.
go to a central computer.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, John Kemeny was one of the founders of, one of the guys who introduced discrete mathematics into the undergraduate
mm-hmm.
curriculum. And he wrote this famous book with Kemeny's Nellan Thompson, as everybody calls it that, I don't know what the actual
mm-hmm.
name of the book was. and he was a great Dartmouth president. He was the Dartmouth president who admitted women
mm-hmm.
to Dartmouth and got Dartmouth through Vietnam trauma.
Mm-hmm.
First foreign-born Ivy League president, I'm told.
Oh.
And we now have a second mathematician president. Did you know that?
I didn't realize that.
Our new president, as of last summer only, is Phil Hanlon, the combinatorialist, who had been provost at the University of Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if you ask me, he looks like another great Dartmouth
uh-huh.
president. So we have a very good history of mathematician
mm-hmm.
presidents.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things this reminds me of is that sort of straddling the area between mathematics and computer science. And some schools are two separate departments, and people tend to do one or the other, or they're split in various ways and so on. But you've very much straddled, gone back and forth between the two.
It's true, and this is maybe more coincidence than planning. But, you know, when I was at Emory, I was member of and then chairman of one of only, I think, two PhD-granting joint departments of mathematics and computer science.
Hmm.
The other one was Dartmouth.
Ah.
Dartmouth split very late.
Mm-hmm.
They split in 94,
mm-hmm.
Years before I got there, but after I left Emory for Bell
mm-hmm.
Labs. And now at Dartmouth, I'm a member of both departments, and
mm-hmm.
I enjoy being a member of both departments.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, as a computer scientist, I'm considered a theorist.
Mm-hmm.
As a mathematician, almost, in a generalized sense, an applied mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoy my colleagues from both
mm-hmm.
departments a lot, and
mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun. I don't recommend this two-department route
mm-hmm.
for junior faculty. I think it's probably better strategy to concentrate on one department,
mm-hmm.
get your tenure.
So right now you are a member of both departments,
but
and they are separate departments.
They are separate departments, mm-hmm. and I'm a member of both, and I'm
mm-hmm.
pretty active in both.
Mm-hmm.
And but yeah, once you're a full professor, it's great. You know what they say
mm-hmm.
about the wife and the mistress.
Right.
So if you have two departments, everybody
mm-hmm.
assumes if you're not at one, you're at the other. Meanwhile, you could be
yeah.
at a coffee shop proving a theorem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's your current research focused on?
Well, for some time now, I've been especially interested in connections between statistical physics
mm-hmm.
and the theory of computing. So I got into this in the mid-90s. Did a lot of work with Graham Bridwell, London School of Economics, and then I continued to work with a bunch of folks, especially folks in or connected with Microsoft Research out in Redmond. And the thing is that, I mean, the most amazing phenomenon in the theory of computing is this amazing gap between tractable and intractable problems, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the fact that you can solve, you know, the Eulerian circuit problem on a graph with 100 vertices in some microseconds, mm-hmm. but the same 100 vertex graph, if you want to solve the Hamilton circuit problem, mm-hmm. will take you, I don't know, a billion years or something like this. And I mean, just amazing gaps. So, and you know, proving that P is not equal to NP is, of course, mm-hmm. we know that's going to be very difficult. But even just trying to understand what's the difference between a tractable problem and an intractable problem is very difficult. And one way to attack it, you know, is try to find problems where when you change a parameter, mm-hmm. it changes from being tractable to intractable.
Almost like a phase transition.
Exactly. The experts in phase transitions are people who do statistical mechanics. Mm-hmm. And so since around mid-90s, the computer scientists, along with combinatorialists and probabilists, mm-hmm. have been getting together mm-hmm. with the statistical physicists and trying to understand, okay, well, wait a minute, yes, we can view random threesat as a problem in statistical physics, but we can also take a statistical physics model like the hardcore lattice gas model, which mm-hmm. is a famous model, and analyze this combinatorially. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, the connection was between tractability and phase transition was somewhat one-sided. We knew lots of cases where on one side of the phase transition, we had a tractable problem. Typically solved using Markov chain Monte Carlo, mm-hmm. because on one side of the phase transition you have rapid mixing. But the problem was on the other side, when you don't have rapid mixing, you don't know that there isn't some other way to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. So you don't know that the statistical physics threshold is exactly the computability mm-hmm. threshold. But we now know that at least one case it is. Mm-hmm. Thanks to work of a bunch of people, culminating in a paper by Alan Sly just last year, mm-hmm. We now know that the threshold for sampling or estimating the number of independent sets in a graph mm-hmm. is exactly at the statistical physics mm-hmm. threshold. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be a lot more of that. I think that the connection between these two things is becoming more important. Mm-hmm. And so and next year I'm co-organizing a special event at ICERM, mm-hmm. and it's called Phase Transitions and Emergent Properties, mm-hmm. and which will explore some aspects of this connection that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But there were also two such events at MSRI and lots of other places mm-hmm. around. I mean, so it's become a phenomenon. I think it's pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm. And but I have to say that even though this is my main, you know, mm-hmm. day interest, I still maintain my traditional lack of self-discipline and am capable of getting interested in almost any problem in computer science or mathematics mm-hmm. that just intrigues me, like the overhanging bricks, so I always have a couple of crazy projects mm-hmm. Going on, sometimes with my students, of course, and others, often with my colleagues around mm-hmm. the world. So, yeah, it's, math is fun. I mean, that's what it is for me, and
But you must also enjoy the teaching side of it too.
Yes, I do have fun. I maybe a little bit of a natural hand in the classroom, and I enjoy having. I have a big crowd this semester, and of course that normally doesn't have a crowd, and I'm actually enjoying it. Although you don't tell that to my chairman.
Okay.
So I mean, we have this honors probability course, and we Dartmouth undergraduates are pretty smart to begin with, and honors probability has always gotten really bright students, typically 12 to 15 students. And you can have them all do individual projects, and you can have a lot of fun with it. But for some reason, we've got 55 students in this class right now. And so that means we can't do individual projects, because by the time they reported on them, we don't have time for anything else in the class. So so there's a challenge to challenging 55 students, you know, wholesale in a big lecture room, and still getting them to participate, still getting to do lots of fun things on the side. So I enjoy that very much. Dartmouth really does take undergraduate teaching very seriously, and that's so they really do expect you to do a good job over there. You can't standards are quite a bit higher than what I found teaching to be, for example, at Harvard and Yale. And so it takes some time and effort, but it's worth it. It's really great students, and they're fun to teach.
So another thread is the puzzle collecting and the Martin Gardner meetings and so on, because I remember your talk, and I think it was Gathering for Gardner number 7, where you gave a talk on some very interesting puzzles and some twists on them. That was one, I think, that included, it was a prisoner issue.
Yes,
and all
that was a talk which was called Puzzles You Think You Must Not Have Heard Correctly.
Yes.
And that was a popular talk. I got a lot. I thought I was persuaded to put some of those up on my website. People ask me all the time about that category of puzzles, and but I also it's natural when I go to Gathering for Gardeners to talk about mathematical puzzles. Of course, it's one of a number of themes at that meeting. And it's lots of fun at those meetings. I love the entertainment by the magicians and all the crazy stuff that people do, both with mathematical puzzles and mechanical puzzles, which I also collect, by the way. And it's a crazy far-out meeting. And I always get wonderful new puzzles that I can add to my collections at the Gathering for Gardner.
You're going to be talking about the puzzle Chomp, or at least the game. And I first learned about it, at least in the direct way, at a Gathering for Gardner. I think it was Eric Demain who talked about it.
Is that right?
And I ended up writing some things on chomp dynamics and what happens over time and various things like that. But I was curious about how your interest in chomp came about.
Well, I heard the puzzle from Paul Hamlet. He liked the puzzle, and he talked about it at an MAA talk, I believe, at some regional MAA meeting. This is wonderful. I love this idea that you could prove that the first player can win it, but we don't know how. And it was just really neat. So that's how I learned it. But I think there's some debate about who invented it. I checked out Wikipedia and so on, so I haven't, and I won't be entering into that in my talk or anything. But to me, I was always associated with Paul Hamlet. Yeah, I know there are actually a bunch of games that have the property that we, using strategy stealing arguments, that we know that the first player has a winning strategy, we don't know what it is. For example, hexisms, ordinary hexes in this category. But the particular proof that's used for Chomp is so cute that I think Chomp is now solved up to at least 3 by-in, right? Could it be farther than that now? You would probably know.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I looked at them.
Yeah. Last time I looked, 3xN was solved, but 4xN was still open. And of course, the general M by N is open. N by N is known because you can win by symmetrizing. You know, these problems get solved sometimes. All of a sudden, somebody gets a great idea. So, there was one combinatorial puzzle which actually happened to be the first puzzle I mentioned in my first book, which has changed, which has grown up and changed in several ways, quite fascinatingly. It just shows you how a puzzle can move along. And the puzzle was the one where you have 50 coins on the table in a line. You remember this one? And Alice and Bob, I mean, the coins are all various denominations, unspecified, and you can see what they are there. And Alice and Bob alternate taking a coin from one end or the other of the row. So they always have a choice of two until Bob gets the last coin, because there's an even number of coins. And the original puzzle is just to prove that Alice can always get at least half the money. And it's a very cute puzzle. And but then, years later, a guy named Dan Brown, one of many guys named Dan Brown, in this case a Californian, came up with a puzzle which incorporates this one as a sort of a sub-puzzle. And it's a very natural, actually practical puzzle. In this puzzle, Alice and Bob are sharing a pizza. It's a round pizza. Cut into an arbitrary number of slices by radial cuts. Okay. And Alice and Bob are both hungry, but they've agreed to share the pizza by what I call the polite pizza protocol, which means that Alice chooses any piece she wants, and they alternate selecting pieces after that, but they always take a piece from the gap. So that they don't reach across the pizza and disconnect it by taking a piece from the back of the pizza. So after the first slice, there's only two choices for each slice until the last slice is taken. And now, the fact is, if a pizza has an even number of slices, which in real life most do, then Alice can use the same strategy on the pizza that she used on the coins problem and make sure she gets at least half the pizza. But what about if the number of pieces is odd? Then the argument doesn't apply, and you would think that that would be even better for Alice, because she now gets more pieces than Bob. But in fact, it turns out that there is a 15-slice pizza that Bob can get 5/9 of, no matter what Alice does. And there is now a proof, I put this out as an open problem for a while, there's now a proof that that Bob can never do any better than that. Alice can always get 4/9 of the pizza. So, and then another, so that got people interested in games like this in general. And the most elegant generalization, I think, was to a game that I call leaf eating. And in this game, you have a tree, right? A graph with no cycles. And you have a quantity marked, just maybe some amount of money at each vertex. And Alice and Bob alternate eating leaves. And the conjecture was that if this tree has an even number of vertices, and no matter what the tree is, and no matter how the leaves are marked with monies, Alice can always get half the money. And so the original problem was just the path version of this. And that problem was out for quite some time. And eventually a married couple of combinatorialists in, I think, Idaho found a beautiful proof that's true. Somewhat non-constructive proof. Amazing that this should be true. That something like this should be true and yet not obvious. Right? I mean, it's such a very general statement, and arbitrary tree with arbitrary real numbers on its vertices. Why should Alice be able to win this game? I mean, it could easily be that every, in the original tree, every leaf has a very small amount of money on each leaf, but a large amount of money on the vertex right behind it. So Alice may have to start this game by giving up a lot of money to Bob. How do you know that she can get it back? I mean, what's going on here?
To finish off, basically, I mean, where do you see yourself, say, about 10 years from now?
Okay, well, so I'm working now on a new puzzle book, which is going to be a big one, and this one will have all the best puzzles from the previous two books, plus lots of new ones. And I want to organize this one into chapters based on technique. So first the puzzles are all presented, and then each chapter I talk about a technique for solving puzzles. And then at the end of each chapter, a serious mathematical theorem that uses that technique in its proof. So in other words, instead of just relying on the intuition that it's good, that solving puzzles is good practice for mathematics, this book will sort of really lay out the groundwork for thinking about solving puzzles can help you. Now, it is conceded that there is a lot more to mathematics than solving puzzles,
right,
and that there is some difference between the talents involved. But nevertheless, the overlap is a happy place and a lot of fun. So, so that's my big puzzle project. As far as research is concerned, I'm still very much into this connection between computability and statistical physics. These days I do quite a bit of probability, as much probability as combinatorics. And I still continue to just try to understand computability and what's going on here, and look for ways in. 10 years from now, I suppose I might be retired. I do have a bunch of family in New York. My twin kids and their spouses and their three children among them. And I'll be spending some time there. Maybe I'll get to play some bridge. I've written a book on bridge. I don't have a time or the venue to play high level bridge up in New Hampshire, but New York may be another matter. I might be able to, maybe if I can slow down some other stuff, I'll have some time for some bridge. But at the moment, as long as my brain seems to be good for proving theorems, that remains my biggest passion.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome.